All right, so are we on? Can you hear me? That should be working. All right, so I'm going to talk about ubiquity of algebraic Stoltz transforms. Where's that stick? There it is. So what possibly could I be talking about? Background here is we're going to talk about some aspects of random matrix theory, but only of the crudest kind, at the law of large numbers level. That's the level at which you study the limiting empirical distribution of eigenvalues. And an empirical result for those who have attempted such calculations is that if you can do it and you can get a formula, it's usually algebraic. And so the question I would like to address, not answer completely, but address, is why do you get an algebraic answer, and what sort of things could you prove about this in general? So let's move on. So here's the talk outline. There's three parts of some. We'll see how long they last. The first part, I'll talk about a few examples of random matrix models that yield algebraic Stoltz transforms. I won't give an exhaustive list, and I mean it's sort of a personal choice because it hits the high points of joint papers that I wrote with Ofer Zeituni. Then in part two, I will discuss in some detail an accidental byproduct of one of those joint papers, and then in part three, give an example which is new, not something in those previous joint papers. Not a very comprehensive example, but just an example which would make it plausible that really, indeed, algebraic Stoltz transforms are ubiquitous. So let us move along. So let's look at part one in a little bit more detail. I'm going to talk about basically three models, and the last, actually, I will talk about very little because I will make up for it by talking about it too much in part three. And in the first two, I will cover two types of random matrix models that give algebraic Stoltz transforms. So let's move in on this. So the basic model that we want to study is one that has been studied on many occasions. As far as the actual law of large numbers goes for this type of thing, I have nothing new on that front to report. So what is the setup? There's a lot of verbiage on the slide, so I wanted to be able to draw on the blackboard. So if you ignore the verbiage up there. What are we really doing? I've got a square, unit square, and I'm going to mark it off into a number of zones, and I'm going to put a number. Except I'm not sure how to write the number, so I won't write one. I'm going to put a number on each one. And then I'm going to use this as the template for building a Wigner-like matrix. I'm going to fill it in with entries that are independent, but for insisting on symmetry as usual. And then within each block, again, obeying the symmetry condition if necessary, within each block we'll fill in IID with the variance fixed within each block. So this is sort of the sort of next level, most obvious, ridiculous generalization of Wigner matrix that you might want to consider. It's called band matrix. As I said, it has been much studied. So I put down the more technical definitions here. And what we want to study is to look at the eigenvalues of this random matrix, and things have been scaled up so that we do honestly expect the empirical distribution of eigenvalues to converge to something.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Well, no, we take one from each matrix. Yeah, it's extremely complicated. No, really, it should be, that should be an N. Yes, indeed. Sorry about that. All right, so through the work of many authors, it's known that this kind of empirical distribution will converge to something, and you can say what that something is. There are various ways of expressing the functional equation here. I picked this one because it was easiest to work with for this talk. So there is the Stoltz transform that we are interested in. There is a limit of the empirical distribution. There is in this game also some auxiliary function which has a parameter in the space that is indexing rows and columns in this template. And then there's a complex parameter, same as in the Stoltz transform. This package characterizes S lambda. I mean, this, because we are assuming that the filter is finite, is really an algebraic equation. And then the Stoltz transform is recovered as some kind of weighted sum of some entries of what is in effect a square matrix of analytic functions. Okay, so there are many names associated to this kind of model. A lot of them are Ukrainian, Pastor for sure, and you know, Korozenko, Arunji, Filchuk, etc., Gyurko. So let us move along. Now I'm putting in a blanket reference. This is maybe not really fair, but at least this is published. You can see we have a lot of references at the end. Now I'm going to actually make a parenthetical remark. There was a question yesterday about CLTs for band matrix models. Actually, we do have one. It doesn't perfectly overlap with the second degree Freeness stuff, and it's actually quite an interesting problem to see how to make it all work together, because the CLT that is mentioned in this, developed in this paper, goes in the direction which would be handled by operator valued stuff on the free probability side. But anyway, that is just a side remark. And also, while I'm mentioning this paper, it's just shameless advertising. That is not the main one I want to talk about. All right. So, in any relatively simple case of this band matrix model, you can prove that S lambda is algebraic by hand. The simplest case, of course, is when sigma is constant. Then you're talking about honest Wigner matrices, and you get the semicircle law. And the Stoltz transform satisfies a nice, simple equation. I hope I wrote it correctly. Maybe I didn't. And then the next simplest is if you just cut in four pieces and you put zero here and here, then you get a model which is sort of the square root of Wishart, the Australian guy. And then you get essentially the Pasteur-Marchenko law to a simple transformation. And again, Stoltz transform is algebraic. So there is a theorem one in this talk. I didn't get there yet. It may be a while. That as a corollary to that, that's the accident to which I referred at the beginning of the talk. No matter what inputs you consider for this model, the Stoltz transform still comes out to be algebraic. And as you might imagine, if it's that general, it's only done because it's being done by some kind of soft method, and there's no explicit way to make the method yield an equation. And then you might ask, well, why bother to prove algebraicity? Well, partly you do it because, well, you can. But the other reason is that it does imply some kind of regularity. It does mean that it limits rather severely the possibilities for the measures that can come up in this kind of model. So then, now we get to the paper that I did mean to talk about a little bit. We considered a more general kind of model built on top of this one, and how is this more general model built up? Well, instead of leaving matrix entries independent but for symmetry, we take each block and involve by some finitely supported function. So we mess up the independence, but not by too much. I mean, we allow one of these entries to depend on its neighbors out to distance 47, and then after that it has to be independent. And the analysis is maybe a little bit interesting. The way that it goes is, I will only say like 30 seconds worth. Usually when you try to prove something by method of moments, which is what we did, you expand out the matrix and look at these long words, and it's sort of like traveling through the matrix a certain way. And what our analysis depends on is that typically, as you travel through the matrix, you make a big jump. And the scale of the jumps that you make is much larger than the scale on which there are interactions between neighboring matrix entries. So there's like a big scale and a little scale, and a little scale is governed by this data, and the big scale is governed by these blocks. And then one really simple example of this kind of thing is start with a Wigner matrix and then just replace every entry, except at the edge where you can do whatever you want, by its four neighbors, the four compass corners. And then more generally, you could apply any kind of finite filtering procedure with enough symmetry and even get a model in this class. But we're not going to linger on the model. Let me just give a few more references now. This is hardly an exhaustive list. You can see more at the end of the preprint I mentioned. Here are some of the, just kind of a random selection. The paper of Splotenko was mentioned before, Spiker's memoir, kind of a recent electrical engineering type paper in which somehow the Wishart analog of this was considered for Gaussian random variables, and there this local dependence was handled by Fourier transforming. So since you're working with Gaussian variables, if you Fourier transform, then you just go back to the old band matrix setting, so then you can get traction that way. So let's forget about any further details of the model. Let's look now at the functional equation that come out. And the functional equations that characterize the Stieltjes transform look pretty much the same as before. There is, however, the integrals are now two variable instead of one variable. I have to explain ever so roughly what the extra variable is doing. So the only thing that's different here, although it's a lot different at the end of the day, is in the class of function S that we allow here. Before, S was the function that simply said what was the variance in each block. Now this function S is a little more complicated. It has to be symmetric because the matrix is symmetric. It's as far as the the Roman variables are concerned, it's still measurable in blocks like that. And but as far as the two Greek variables, those you're supposed to have a finite Fourier expansion, just sort of trig polynomial expansion. And that trig polynomial expansion codes the local structure of dependence in the matrix. So and then using the as of yet stated theorem one, as of yet unstated theorem one, the Stoeglius transform in this case is still also algebraic. And also this auxiliary function C is algebraic in a suitable sense too. And the corollary 2, as you might imagine, contains corollary 1 as a special case. And really, theorem 1 was a byproduct of the proof of this corollary. I mean, so I am perhaps somewhat perversely emphasizing some tiny technical point of our paper in this talk, but okay. So let's see. So I'll go to my last example. There's only this one slide for now. So many examples of random variables with algebraic Stoeglius transforms are produced by applying theories of R and S transforms. In particular, if you take Bernoulli random variables and you combine them either by multiplying or adding in the free context, you get algebraic distributions. This is clear from the algebraic structure of the R and S transforms. But the third part of the talk is devoted to working out an example that is beyond any of those classes of examples. Okay, so let's look at this algebraicity criterion. So maybe the first part is kind of dry. I'll go quick. The problem is it isn't really tolerable to state it unless we have a little bit of vocabulary in place. So germs were mentioned in the talk this morning, but I will go over it quickly. So a function element in this context is just a holomorphic function defined in the neighborhood of the origin. And we say that two such things are equivalent if in a yet smaller neighborhood, that's inside both of the neighborhoods of definition, we have agreement of the functions. And equivalence classes are germs. So germ is just enough information to define the function locally, and if you talk about germs, well, then you don't have to worry very much about domains of definition and so forth. So in particular, if you have germs vanishing at the origin and you have another germ, mentioned capital N, then you could compose. There are various classes of germs that we will be interested in, but let's make some remarks first. Holomorphic function defined in expected open neighborhood is an identically vanishing germ at the origin, then it vanishes identically throughout that connected neighborhood, so there's no information lost in passing to the germ. And more importantly, this ring ON, the set of germs, is a ring. And main advantage of working with germs is because we can talk about functional composition easily. I don't have to keep saying things about keep shrinking neighborhoods or anything. But then there are various classes of germs we're interested in. There are polynomial germs, ones that are represented by polynomials, ones that are represented by rational functions, and then particularly of interest to us, ones that are algebraic, ones that satisfy. So let's maybe just linger over this for just 2 seconds. We'll say a germ is algebraic if there's a polynomial that we can plug the coordinates in and then also the function such that we get identically zero, and the polynomial, of course, should not be identically zero. And then, although it isn't completely obvious, the class of such functions does form a ring, so we can add them and multiply them. And also, these various classes of germs that we mentioned are stable under composition. This is very useful. All right. So anyway, now we got vocabulary out of out of the way. The theorem is this. You give me some terms that belong to the string of rational terms. So just rational functions, but we're looking at them very locally. And if they satisfy this condition involving determinant, which should be familiar, I'll mention that in a minute. And if we have some terms that satisfy a system of equations like this, so this is as before when we were looking at this definition of algebraic, but now we have a system of equations. Under all these conditions, then in fact these terms have to be algebraic. So this is some kind of reformulation in language that perhaps is uniquely comprehensible to no one, but so just a reformulation of the result that we proved in this preprint. Now we have to make some important remarks. So first one is that the determinant condition is exactly the same as in the implicit function theorem, and so you just give me some terms satisfying that determinant condition, then of course I will have terms vanishing at the origin that satisfy that system of equations, and they're unique. So theorem one just amplifies the implicit function theorem. It says that if, moreover, you knew the equations were rational, then the functions that come out that you knew existed anyway, in fact, are algebraic. And now number two, I have to say that theorem one, as a theorem of unit of algebra, is like of zero novelty, absolutely none. I mean, the point is only that it is a way to prove that things are algebraic in situations which, amazingly enough, do arise a lot in random matrix theory. So, and sort of the philosophy of it, let's go back. If you want to prove something is algebraic, then of course the first thing you try to do is write down the polynomial equation. So you need a polynomial of two variables, and you want to plug in the coordinate and the function and get zero. But how do you get such a function? Well, usually you have some more complicated system of equations, and then you try to eliminate variables. And if you have several equations and several variables, as we all know, this can become very painful. You can pursue it a little bit farther with computer algebra systems, and then it's amusing, you know, that you feed in a few innocent looking equations and get, you know, 50 degree polynomials and things like that. But so that's exactly what we don't do here. I mean, the philosophy here is, well, we're willing to accept to have a lot of equations in a lot of variables, as long as the equations are simple. At least they're simple enough so that there's one point we can point to. We said they're so simple that locally they look like a nice, cleanly cutting linear system of equations. And that is good enough for our purposes. So hint of proof. Well, I don't know. This is just kind of a joke, but the point is that you have a bunch of equations that live in a certain very special local ring, and about this particular local ring, you know quite a lot. In particular, there are two seemingly different theories of dimension, of ideals. One is based on transcendence degree, and the other is essentially homological. And the fact that the two of them match up perfectly is what makes the proof of the theorem. So now, let's make a scholarly remark. So if I wanted to prove a given Stoltz transform is algebraic, first of all, I would rewrite it like this. I would write, just change coordinates, and I have a power series with unit constant terms. And then, I don't really care about it for z large. I really only care about the term. If I can prove something about the germ, that's fine. I mean, that's what I need to do. So, but if I want to use the theorem, well, even though I'm just proving some harmless one-dimensional statement, I have to actually be willing to move into this higher dimensional environment, because otherwise I won't be able to get any traction. The point is that I'm leaving undone explicitly all the elimination of variables. And this procedure is actually natural, because in practice, as I try to explain in my example, what nature seems to have on offer in this game is large systems of equations, but often very simple, merely quadratic, among large numbers of variables. This is exactly what we can analyze this way. So let's explain now how this works out as an application to the basic band matrix model. So let's go back here. Not the... Oops! I caused a fatal interaction. Okay. So where does that go? Maybe there. Either that or it blows up the universe. Okay. So we're not talking about the fancy schmancy thing. Just doing this. So how do you prove the algebraic Stieltjes transform in this basic band matrix model is actually algebraic in this particular case? Well, after you do a small amount of algebraic prep, what you have to prove is this. You have some n by n matrix of complex numbers, and you have some germs vanishing at the origin, and they satisfy a certain nonlinear system of equations. And what you want to be able to infer from that system of equations is that those functions are algebraic. Well, one possible proof is that no sane person could doubt this, but using the theorem, you write down this collection of rational functions, and you notice that in this particular case, that determinant is really easy to calculate. It's 1. And then, of course, the given functions satisfy precisely the kind of system of equations we need, so we apply the theorem. And the application in the fancier band matrix model is similar, but it is more complicated, not suitable for torturing audiences with. Okay. So now we get to the free coin tossing part. So what is it that I want to do? So I'm trying to make a case that any time that you really think that you could prove that Stieltjes transform was algebraic, in fact it is. So in order to make you believe this, I have to give you some example more beyond the seemingly rigged ones that I have already discussed. So what I want to do is look at the distribution of an arbitrary non-commutative polynomial in freely independent Bernoulli random variables of parameter 1/2. I will change coordinates, though, so the eigenvalues are 1 and minus 1. Anyway, I want to show that such a thing is algebraic by applying theorem 1. There was a paper a few years ago by Benoit Collin, here somewhere, I guess, in which these kind of projectors were discussed. I'm not using anything out of that paper, but certainly it got me thinking about it. The interesting thing is that for this purpose of digging up suitable equations, methods of random walk on groups and trees are very useful. Okay, so what is the model? The model is this. Start with a polynomial and non-commuting variables, several non-commuting variables. Let me take some independent, high-distributed unitary matrices of ever-growing size. I also form a diagonal matrix with equal numbers of 1 and ones and minus ones as eigenvalues. And then I form a random matrix by independently conjugating this matrix D and plugging into the polynomial. So what we want to do is we want to say something about the spectrum of x and the limit as n tends to infinity. Of course, I didn't say self-adjoint. I guess I could say self-adjoint. Then I would really be talking about, honestly, the spectrum. But everything I'm going to do is algebra. So, in general, all I'm doing is I'm looking at the generating function for the traces of higher and higher powers of this matrix. It doesn't really matter about self-adjointness. So we want to be able to say something halfway intelligent about the spectrum of X. Particularly, we want to say something about the limiting Stieltjes transform. So, let's formulate an actual result. Take now the formal Stieltjes transform. So, that's just going to be the generating function of the normalized trace of the various powers of this random matrix from theory of asymptotic freeness. We know that the limits on n exist. So, this gadget makes sense at least as a formal power series, and what we want to prove is that it actually is algebraic. So we will sketch a proof. Of course, this is not... So the first thing is to get rid of the random matrices, because this is not really a random matrix problem at all. It's kind of just a setup. We need to do is perform some kind of an analysis on what arguably is the simplest group to work on for this kind of thing. It's a group generated by some independent involutions. This is a nice thing. This is why I need the blackboard again. And I didn't trip over that this time. I am educable. This particular group is nice because the Cayley graph is very friendly. It is an infinite tree. We have a kind of a nice environment to work in. And on this group, we'll consider the trace that takes an element of the group ring to the coefficient of the identity element. This would be the natural trace to study this in the Neumann algebra context. So after asymptotic freeness kicks in, the expression for this generating function sigma is simply what I've written here. It's the generating function that gives the traces of higher and higher powers of this big nasty group ring element. So now theorem two is just some kind of statement about algebra. We want to prove that this generating function is algebraic. And let's notice at least we have some kind of very crude estimate that means that this power series is convergent. So, in fact, sigma at least is a germ. You know, so it's in the ball game. So as I drew over there, the Cayley graph for G with respect to the given generators is an L-valent tree. If you think of each edge as being labeled by a letter. So we're going to use some random walk intuition to analyze things. So the first thing I'm going to do is write out this group ring element as a linear combination, and P is because we're thinking of P as a transition function for a Markov process. Okay, so it doesn't sum to one, and the probabilities are complex numbers. Well, we don't really have to worry about that. It will still work out. I guess I'm going to assume that P at the identity is zero. That doesn't change anything, really. Okay, so now, next thing you're going to have to do is this group ring element has a support, which does not include the identity here, but maybe it goes out here. And so we want to pick a set, a ball, in this tree about the origin, which is big enough so that the transition function is supported in S. And then, so now what we're going to do is we want to actually think about what. So let's be slightly formal, talk about VS paths. These will be sequences in G so that, so to speak, the steps are in S. So, and the V in the definition is where we insist the path should stay, except for the last step, where we boot it out. And then for these guys, we need to consider a generating function. And this ghastly object would be playing the role that was previously played by chi in those earlier sets of equations. So this definition, whatever it is cooked up so that we have a nice equivariance property. The symmetry is crucial. So what's going on here? So having introduced that generating function, we can express the function that we're really interested in terms of it by thinking about random walk the usual way. I mean, you think of, in order to calculate this guy, we need to understand loops in G, or random walks on this tree, except they're not simple random walks, they're ones where you can go a certain number of steps away. It's okay. There's a bound in the number of steps you can take in any given move. And, okay. So the first formula just says that, okay, if you have a loop, first you must step away, and then you'll come back. That's really all there is to it. And in particular, though, everything I need is present in this kind of generating function C, so let's keep it. I mean, let's just focus on such things for now. We don't have to worry about sigma really anymore. So now, in order to handle the rest of the formulas, I need a little bit of matrix technology. It's convenient to express things in terms of G by G matrices, which, however, are finitely supported. So the only really important notation here is the square brackets just means I'm going to take a set and I'm going to take my matrix and I'm going to throw everything out, put everything to zero except for those positions in the matrix that belong to the set T. And then also I need a notation for taking one of these matrices and then just shifting it by an element in the group. And then the two notations interact in this way. And then, let's see, we need a special matrix. So I'm going to recode the transition function actually as a matrix. The way things are set up, this matrix is invariant under shifting. That's pretty important. Invariant under shifting, and because of that invariance, then we more or less trivially have this. And if we take this matrix, this is a re-expression. The matrix notation of this. Okay. So no human beings can possibly absorb at this state, at this rate, but okay, we'll get to the punchline. Yeah. Right, so yes. I mean, the way I'm thinking of it, the Cayley graph is made by right multiplication, so that right multiplications are available for symmetries. Yeah. Okay, so now there's nice geometry here. If we have any old set in G, we can define a boundary. Just so I guess it's like the entryway, the foyer. So what is this really? If you want to get into the set B, but you're only allowed to take steps in S, this is where you have to come in. And if you're trying to get out of B and you can only take steps in S, this is where you would have to leave from, and the two sets are equal because there was some symmetry built into the choice of the set F. Also, taking boundaries is respected by... Oh, what I said was exactly backwards. No, left multiplication is the symmetry, and right multiplication is giving the Cayley graph. Oh, well, sorry. Anyway, it's symmetrical once you get left and right straightened out. And never easy. you can forget about the other part. So now we come to the really crucial thing. I mean, how are you going to get a recursion? How are you going to get any system of equations? It's because the whole game is self-similar in a certain way. So it's probably worth saying absolutely nothing new, but... So first of all, you can... If you omit this point, then the tree falls into a certain number of pieces. And then each one of those you can follow out to a certain distance. And then out here at the very end are copies of the same, which is what this says. So this situation is the whole game is self-similar. And now, in any kind of Markov chain situation, you have an equation more or less like this. We'll call it a Gruen equation. Undoubtedly, I'll be corrected after the talk. I'm saying nearly correct terminology, but you have a certain kind of equation, quadratic, I wish to point out, which says that if I take a path that starts in this collection of boundaries, and I break it according to sojourns in each of the subsets in my disjoint union, then I can do that. And this equation just expresses that one can do that. And, okay, so there's a special case of the Gruen equation, which allows us to take this function, in terms of which we know we can express sigma, and we can express entries in here in terms of entries in that matrix. So, and in fact, if you look more closely, here we have a finite matrix of holomorphic functions, finite collection of finite matrices of holomorphic functions. And if I know the algebraicity of entries of those matrices, then I will have the proof of the theorem I'm trying to prove. And then finally, okay, you put all this stuff together and you get a recursion. And there's no sense in even trying to explain exactly what's going on here, but you're just supposed to look at this with your weakest pair of glasses and say, my goodness, it's quadratic. Okay, so now if you work backwards through these Gruen equations, you can check that sigma can be expressed as a rational function of the entries of these awful things. And so, indeed, sigma was algebraic. Yeah. So, what is the concluding remark here? It would seem, really, that algebraicity is actually coding for some other kind of structure, which all these random matrix problems seem to have in common, which will, I suppose, be a surprise to no one. That there are usually trees lurking. But in particular, this style of analysis with trees should prove quite a lot of other statements. So I have not checked in all the details, but I'm pretty sure that you can make this work. So, for example, if you take an arbitrary non-commutative polynomial and independent Wigner matrices, you should also get an algebraic Stieltjes transform of a limiting measure. And presumably, you can mix and match many of your favorite random variables in this way and still be guaranteed to get an algebraic Stieltjes transform. I guess that would be the entirety of what I wanted to talk about. Thanks.